Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's program is seriously ironic. We're going to hear from Isaac Wilder, and he's going to talk about irony, and he's also going to talk about the Internet and how the Internet can be used for effective outlets for dissent. This program was recorded on Sunday, November 29th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will follow our usual format. There will be a shorter than usual presentation, approximately 20 minutes. We'll take a short break after that, and then we'll have a considerable amount of questions from the audience to round out the show tonight. So let's go right to the introduction from Rita Norton, and we'll hear from Isaac Wilder tonight on the All Souls Forum.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. Now is the time to turn off your phones for the entire program. FYI, we are being recorded for in-church use and for probable broadcast on KKFI. The last time Isaac Wilder spoke at the forum, an icy day in January of 2014, he told us mostly about the potential for free internet networks, and he revealed insights into dilemmas facing our inequitable society. He also told us about the free network that he had set up for the people of the Occupy movement in New York's Zuccotti Park at the end of 2011. Regarding that experience, Mr. Wilder had observed that the Occupy movement was not as much a protest as a demonstration of what a community might look like. And that might relate to what he's talking about today, about the value of irony as an act of radical resistance. Isaac Wilder.
Thank you, Rita. Sometimes it feels as if there is no way, that no way is the only way. We peek out at the world and see terror and beauty, but it's not the stuff of sense. We're propelled through life by forces beyond our control, beyond our comprehension. It would be all too easy to survey our situation and come to the conclusion that we are hopelessly lost. Such a conclusion would no doubt be convenient, as it would free us from whatever sense of responsibility we may feel with regard to the fate of this world. And yet we're here. More or less moral beings, seeking, craving, making meaning, making purpose, making direction. Despite it all, we cling to hope. How can this be? The hope that I have is in the nonsense, in the contradictions that light themselves and burn themselves and explode themselves at random. What is terror? What is fear? What is destiny but the manifestation of faith? What can we do but go back to God? God. A word so meaningless that it has become the song of the hopeless and the faithful at once. It is everything. That is what it is. Everything is everything, and that's not necessarily good, but it certainly is. It is. We will return to the subject of God, but first let me introduce myself. My name is Isaac Wilder, and I was born here. I grew up here. I like it enough here, but I'm planning to leave soon. I've spent most of my adult life working to make the internet better by making it something that we all own and hold in common. Such an idea is doubtlessly a little crazy, but then that's what makes it great. Today's talk isn't about free networks, however, at least not directly. My idea for today is to talk about irony. To talk about trying to make everything make sense without trying to make everything make sense. I intend to keep my remarks brief. I'll speak first about what I believe it means to live ironically. Next, I'll explore the relationship between irony and faith. Finally, I'll talk about where we go from here. The philosopher Thomas Nagel said that if in the eyes of eternity there's no reason to believe that anything matters, then that doesn't matter either, and we can approach our absurd lives with irony instead of heroism or despair. To put it another way, there is an incredible sense of freedom that comes with the realization that we are, simply put, small things. We do not have to do what is expected of us because ultimately, what does it matter? Putting aside the notion that we are more or less divine than any other part of creation, we gain the confidence to embark freely and fearlessly on making a world that is more to our liking. Instead of pathetically despairing, we're able to shrug off the world's derision. Instead of embracing a self-centered heroism that blinds us to our own ignorance and interdependence, we're able to find and embrace the wisdom of the other. If we pay attention to the world around us, we're confronted constantly with the absurd. My suggestion is that we stop trying to make sense of it. It seems to me that we've tried that approach, that we've been trying that approach for 400 years. We build cognitive models around the idea that the world is full of so-called rational actors, and yet we watch as those same actors destroy and defile their own home, waste the vast human potential of all those that are kept in poverty. Confronted with the absurdities of our present situation, perhaps it is time that we actually embrace the absurdity inherent in each of us. So what does it mean, practically speaking, to live ironically? I think it starts with really taking to heart that we are wrong all the time. That generally speaking, we are, as individuals and as a society, seriously prone to error. This notion is superficially obvious, and yet we consistently operate as if it were not the case. We cast aside doubt in order to avoid being paralyzed by it. But is there not another way? A way of taking action even in full consciousness of our fallibility? I think Walt Whitman said it best in Song of Myself, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I'm large, I contain multitudes." I've watched the bulk of my generation become conditioned to apathy. I believe that this apathy is rooted in a desire for consistency. In order to provide for our basic needs, we work inside a system that is manifestly bereft of justice. What good would it do to fight for justice on the weekend when Monday through Friday is spent selling software and burning dinosaur bones? We cleave to coherence, but the coherence we perceive is illusory. Experience itself is fractious. We take ourselves so seriously, seek to be reasonable in our doings, and in so doing, miss so many opportunities to make magic. Reconciling ourselves with the contradiction inherent in our lived experience doesn't require us to cast aside reason, but it does require a marriage of reason with feeling and intuition. To put it another way, it requires faith. I'm not talking about the hopeless, helpless kind of faith that men in black robes profess of a belief in God. When you take God to mean nature, or the sum of all things, or the thing of which there is only one, then belief's got nothing to do with it. What I'm talking about is the faith that comes with acknowledging yourself not as a being made in the image of God, but as a living, breathing part of the everything. Such a faith grants us the freedom to be really in ourselves, peering out into and beyond the world. Kierkegaard says in Fear and Trembling, "He who loves God without faith reflects upon himself. He who loves God believingly reflects upon God." Such faith gives us the freedom to act in keeping with our conscience, even if we don't understand why we feel compelled to act. Kierkegaard gives the example of Abraham. But what did Abraham do? He arrived neither too soon nor too late. He mounted the ass. He rode slowly along the way. All that time he believed. He believed that God would not require Isaac of him. Whereas he was willing nevertheless to sacrifice him if it was required. He believed by virtue of the absurd. For there could be no question of human calculation, and it was indeed the absurd that God, who required it of him, should the next instant recall the requirement. I'll interject here to talk about the connection between the absurd and the ironic. I take irony to mean that which is deliberately absurd. Irony, in a sense, is absurdity over time. So if Abraham believed by virtue of the absurd, then certainly his actions were ironic. I think it is indeed ironic that one revered as a holy patriarch should be so revered for his willingness to do the unthinkable. He climbed the mountain. Even at the instant when the knife glittered, he believed that God would not require Isaac. He was indeed astonished at the outcome, but by a double movement, he had reached his first position, and therefore he received Isaac more gladly than the first time. Let us go further. We let Isaac be really sacrificed. Abraham believed. He did not believe that someday he would be blessed in the beyond, but that he would be happy here in the world. God could give him a new Isaac, could recall to life him who had been sacrificed. He believed by virtue of the absurd, for all human reckoning had long since ceased to function. Here I'll interject to say that by any reasonable standard, Abraham's actions are nothing if not certifiably insane. There's no reason or sense here. That's the point, that sorrow can derange a man's mind. That we see. And it is sad enough that there is such a thing as strength of will which is able to haul up so exceedingly close to the wind that it saves the man's reason, even though he remains a little queer. That too one sees. I have no intention of disparaging this, but to be able to lose one's reason, and therefore the whole of finiteness of which reason is the broker, and then, by virtue of the absurd, to gain precisely the same finiteness, that appalls my soul. But I do not for this cause say that it is something lowly, since on the contrary, it is the only prodigy. It sounds a bit strange, but I take this to mean that Abraham's virtue, his willingness to sacrifice Isaac, was actually rooted in the sort of faith that allows one to not take things too seriously. To talk to God, maybe get a bit pissed off or confused at what God is asking, and then roll up the sleeves and say, gotta do what you gotta do, que sera. I think there is a good, rich irony in deriving this lesson from the would-have-been brutal throat-letting of one's own child. The Bible is rich with that sort of moral irony, but I believe that the point remains. That there is a virtue in a willingness to follow the dictates of one's own whole self. Not just the dictates of reason, or the feelings of the heart, or the hunches of intuition, but the sum of those things, which is indeed greater than its parts. Of course, we don't live in an age of miracle or prophecy, if such an age ever did exist. In these times, those who embrace and enact the absurdity of their whole being, those who live ironically, are most often called crazy. So, at last, let's hear it for the crazy ones. Let's hear it for those that are shuttered away in whatever institution, but whose faith sustains them, allows them to breathe and shine and glow. If we as a people are to avoid the calamities that seem so imminent, of war and famine and drought and all that biblical brimstone, it will be by virtue of the crazy. And I do not mean the eccentric magnates and titans of industry whose rational path is what I would term violently sane. I mean the man in chains who has a verse to share. I mean the woman in rags that goes home and draws because she cannot not. I mean the poet, the playwright, the artist, the hacker, the builder, the maker, the part in each of us that knows in our bones that not only is there the divine in us, but that we are in the divine. I'll leave you with this thought. That whatever notion calls to you, especially that notion that you yourself dismiss as crazy, impossible, too distant, that is a notion that's worth pursuing. For me, that notion is of something resembling the internet, but made to free us rather than enslave us. I have full faith that we will one day share a global brain, and that when that day comes, the following day will bring a world without strife. Consider your own soul. Listen to whatever idea you must bashfully half-mutter. Remember that you yourself are a small part of God and are free to do the unexpected. The age of reason is over. The age of irony has just begun.
Listening to Isaac Wilder, our topic tonight is seriously ironic. We owe you a break. There's a few messages we need to get to you. We will come back with the question and answer portion of our program tonight. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. This program features Isaac Wilder, and it was recorded on Sunday, the 29th of November of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. So we'll be right back after these.
Everett Murphy. Butch Murphy. How do you know when the followers of crazies then become violent? Say, for instance, the Planned Parenthood event this weekend. This person was thinking absurd thoughts, and how do you know what to follow with this concept?
I don't. I don't know that the ideas that I espoused are universalizable. So in that sense, maybe it's a bit like gun ownership, where there are probably, you know, there are circumstances where someone can reasonably justify adherence to their own craziness, to their own faith, and there, you know, it's up to each of us to say, well, that, you know, that one's not, that one isn't, and it's the point is not to reconcile it. The point is not to say abolish mental institutions. It's a different conversation. It's like, no, there are crazy people. It doesn't necessarily come together. But if we just take it for ourselves and we trust ourselves to and have faith in ourselves, and we just stop it there and we don't apply it to somebody else, then I think it works.
You mentioned that you are about to take your talents to another location. I'm curious to know what you think from the travels that you have had. How does place fit into your notion of irony lived?
I suppose if you know, I think there's a connection, deep connection between the absurd, the ironic, and generally somewhere around the notion of the unexpected. And so when we become, I guess I'd say, too familiar with a place, I think it's always possible to find the unexpected. And in a lot of cases, the better we think we know a place, the more capable it is of surprising us or presenting us with absurdity or irony, but I suppose after a while, it's a balance of saying, well, this place, because I think I know it well, can surprise me, versus, well, I've never been to Montana, so that's got to be a surprise. You know, that's got to be unexpected, and just balance it. You know, any going is a coming, and we tend as people to return to the places we've been, and so I think that's a good balance to keep between staying and going.
So Isaac, how did your namesake as the laughable one enter into your theory of contradiction and absurdity? How has that impacted you?
I'm not sure. Now that I think about it, there's definitely something there. I mean, one thing I wanted to figure out how to put in the talk that I guess mentioned but couldn't really find a way to bring in is just really not taking ourselves seriously, just laughing at ourselves and laughing at our situation and just finding humor in it. So I think in that sense it's perfect that you know the parable is about a kid named Laughter. So yeah, let's laugh. That's absurd. That's absurd.
I'm wondering a couple questions actually. If there's too much irony in the world today, like the irony of in Biloxi, Mississippi, in which a waitress asked a man to quit smoking in a restaurant, and he shot her in the head. And as she lay there dying, she kept asking people if they'd had a nice Thanksgiving. It's like a Quentin Tarantino movie. And do we get too much irony? And in too many doses of it, in the movies and in other media that influence life in a curious way?
I'd say, yeah, we've got way too much irony and absurdity. But I think for me, the point, I guess, is that in confronting the abundant irony and absurdity of the world, trying to make sense of it, I don't think is going to help us. I agree that there's too much tragic irony. There's too much, and that for me is the point that maybe the only way to make it better, so to speak, is to just sit with that irony and not try to make sense of it, not try to understand how that could be or look into that guy's background and pick apart and make policy and do all of these rational behaviors and reasonable responses to that. Maybe the thing to do is just be floored by the absurdity of that and really just take it and let that guide us in subtle ways in our approach to other people, and in that way not seek to cure our ails through rationality or reason, but through the same mechanism and to just sort of patch up the fabric, and that if we take and sort of imbibe the absurdity of something, of an event like that, then our whole being responds, our soul responds, and we become more whatever, more tender, more aware, and maybe that's the only way out of the mess.
When I say three cheers for the crazies, I'm really saying three cheers for me, who spends all of her energy and any kind of funds that I have on trying to convince people that they really need to change their ways for the globe to continue. I know there are many other kinds of crazies out there. One of the things you spoke of earlier was the possibility of radical resistance. Can you relate that to your perception, your conception, your talk about irony?
So I think with the world as it is, the only way to be radical is through irony. It's in this day and age, it's ironic to be radical, because if you look at the take just the force of arms amassed by our government, the notion that there's really anything we can do is absurd. It's an absurd notion that we can somehow seek to dismantle or topple a regime like that. That's crazy. They have so many nuclear bombs and tanks and guns and stuff. And so that for me is the connection that in order to be radical now, we have to embrace the absurdity of, we have to just say, yeah, it's crazy. It's when somebody says like, oh, well, that'll never work. It's like, okay, well, you know, this is something that for me, it kind of hits home, because when you look at the internet's this huge thing run by governments and run by these big corporations, Cisco and Microsoft, well, you know, just all these huge multinational corporations. And when you say, oh yeah, we want to make it a commons, I mean, the general reaction is, well, okay, that's not going to happen. And so after a while, I think the only thing you can do is either sort of turn around and go home, or, you know, go to the office, or, you know, embrace the irony of that in a bear hug and just say, okay, we're friends now. We're just going to live together, and this whole thing is going to be wacky, and we're just going to have fun with it, because why not? What else is there to do? What else, you know, what else, what's more worthwhile of our time than doing what people don't expect and doing what people think is just out there. It's fun to just be out there, you know, I guess it's a matter of personal taste, but I think what's not absurd to me is just kind of boring. It's like, well, what's the point? More apps? I don't know.
Is it fair to say that you consider yourself a digital native?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to lay out a hypothesis and then get your reflection as a digital native. I'm old enough to distinguish between the arrival of the internet and the arrival of what I would call digital immersion, cell phones, pads, wireless, combination of wireless and wired internet. It appears to me that the arrival of digital immersion adds to the existence of the atmosphere and the atmosphere, a third all-encompassing sphere, and that it is radically different from whatever we thought the internet was going to turn into. So would you comment on that?
I was over at my dad's house for Thanksgiving, and I went to the bathroom, and there's an old, like a 1992 copy of Wired magazine in there, or 93, something like that, you know, early 90s. And one of the articles in there was the World Wide Web, and all the ads had they had like a Gopher address and a World Wide Web and an FTP address, and it struck me. What struck me about it was that the internet was kind of like an interlibrary system. Really, it was for obviously transmitting information, but more. I think the terminology that got applied early on had this unintended consequence, right? Also in there was an ad that said the information superhighway, which is a term we really most of us haven't heard in a while, but for a while was what it was all called, you know, the information superhighway. Part of me feels like if they had called it the knowledge railroad, we'd be much better off. I'm not sure it would have made a difference, but to the point, to the notion that it became something. Became something else. That, yeah, I mean, I think the internet in general, wherever you look in it, is basically a lab animal that escaped. And it's just all it is a bundle of unintended consequences. All it is the unanticipated side effects and sort of chaos theory in action of just one decision rolling into another, band-aids on top of band-aids, duct tape, dental floss, and tie it all up in a bow, and that's the system. And so, it is interesting for me I wish I could believe that sort of that's us together becoming something, that we have a voice or a say or some agency in what that is becoming, but I think it's very deceptive, at least in general, and that for the most part, those shifts in sort of in the trajectory of the internet are calculated for profit, and so it's not surprising to me that what could have become. And it is, in some ways, a knowledge engine has become much more about entertainment. And I think that is just in line with the interests of the people who own the infrastructure.
Going back to an early reference of yours on the fact that we are frequently wrong about things, when older people look at younger people and their influence on society and culture now, they frequently say, much of what you're doing is really worthwhile and intelligent, but you're not voting. And so the political figures who could be possibly making some changes that would benefit society are looking at that group and saying, well, they might believe in this and this and this, but they're not voting. So why should I pay any attention to them? Mm-hmm. So how do we resolve those contradictory feelings where the younger people are saying, yeah, we are doing a lot of worthwhile things, we're just not voting because we don't believe in this type of political establishment?
So I will fess up to being, well, I guess only of late, and I'm not sure where it'll go. But I'm not sure that it can be resolved. I'm not sure that there is any resolution to find. I think that, you know, our job now is to see in the parallax and say, okay, there's these two positions, but the benefit of opposing positions, or call it dialectic, right? Call it, you know, two positions that are not compatible, ultimately, you know, maybe there is some synthesis to be achieved, but it seems more likely to me that one really salient feature of that mindset, of the mindset of, well, this system's broken, is that If you believe that, if you believe this political system is broken and it's not worthwhile to vote, then it's a sort of independent-minded thing that says, okay, well, we're going to go off and just, to whatever extent possible, without more widely interacting, without spending time and energy trying to affect an electoral process that is so badly broken, we'll just go live the way we think we ought to. And so I'm not sure that any resolution is necessary, because the one doesn't really ask anything from the other. And by no means do I think that that is not without serious problems, but I'm not sure that there is a resolution to be had.
In a way, my question follows on the previous. Society has, since time immemorial, debated the role of the individual versus the role of the collective. It seems to me that if I embrace what you talk about and recognize and accept the absurdity and the irony associated with where we are today, it's a sophisticated, erudite way of basically saying, I have somebody's permission to cop out of my role in society, that I have no obligation beyond that of myself, and I don't have the basis for creative interaction, collective interaction. How do you feel about that? Am I overinterpreting, or is that at least an element?
So for me, it's I guess this relates back to I think my response to the first question, in that perhaps these dictates are only applicable within sort of the sphere of oneself. We can't seek to apply them to others. But that being said, when we do apply them, or for me, I'll just speak for myself. For me, where this ends up is actually quite, it's just the opposite, is that we in recognizing our sort of place inside God, inside the divine, that for me leads sort of directly and immediately to a sense of connectedness. To, you know, if God is one, then we're all the same thing. We're all the same thing. And so I'm sure that such a notion could manifest very differently for different people, and I'd say power to them. For me, these are the ideas, because I guess to me it's actually a little bit absurd to trust other people and to work with other people, because we can never know another's mind. We can never really know. But where I go from here is actually to community, despite the impossibility of knowing other people and working with and fundamentally or ultimately really knowing somebody else, we try anyways, and that's sort of where I end up. But I can see how someone would take it the other direction. But what I would say is, okay, so for someone who takes it the other direction, they take it the other direction, and in embracing that sort of plurality, I think is not a bad thing.
I'm interested in your comments about how people learn about what irony is, and is it some part of our educational system that eventually people figure out what it is? And what I'm thinking of is my two younger grandchildren are almost 12 and almost 14 now, were born in France and have lived all their lives in France. They're fluent in English because that's what my daughter taught them when they were growing up. And their ability to read words in English is above what their understanding is of some of the content. And so they would pick up books that had been hers that they would read on one level, but it was a totally different level than what it was meant for. And some was, they're not familiar with U.S. history, and so that affected things. And also their ability to read the words, again, is above their ability to understand things. And one of them, when she was about 8 or so, had gotten done reading an adult book and missed a lot of the point of it. And I was trying to explain to her what irony was. And I had absolutely no way to do it. I gave up. So how do people learn about irony in the first place?
That's a great question. I spent a while kind of banging my head on that one last night, and I didn't really come up with anything great. I kept kind of going in circles of, who was the Supreme Court justice who said, with regard to, I guess he was speaking of pornography, I can't describe it, but I know it when I see it. We just learn sort of. So last night I was going in circles between absurdity and irony, saying, oh, irony is absurdity in action. Absurdity is sort of irony in an object or something like that. And it just kept going around. And I realized that experientially speaking, at least for me, I just gave a talk on irony. I'm not really sure what it is. Or absurdity. I'm not really sure there's a very coherent definition, but I think it's the type of thing. I think humans, generally speaking, are sort of pattern machines. We recognize patterns, and so over the course of our lifetimes, depending on how much irony we're exposed to, we get a more finely tuned sort of irony meter. Just because there's this sort of constant revelation of it where something happens and then somebody wise says, oh, how ironic. And when you're a kid, you say, how's that ironic? Or, it's just, there's an art. It's an art form. To appreciate irony is an art. And it's something that you just have a sense of. And you say, oh, and you can look for it anywhere. You can go and find irony. And that, for me, is one of the most beautiful things about it, that no matter where you are, in a dungeon, in a castle, in a skyscraper, you can find irony if you look. And that, so actually the sort of the idea for this talk started a while back. My mom said to me, we were talking, and she said to me, the essence of life is irony. And it really just stuck with me, and I started thinking about it, and I like that. I find it comforting because you can find it anywhere, and so it's nice to just value something that's in good supply, because then it's abundant, and we can have it whenever we want. But to how we learn it, I think it's just. It gets pointed out, and we say, oh, that's irony. Oh, that's irony. And over time, it builds up this very complex notion. And it'd be interesting to see what, a French speaker would find ironic. I would imagine it'd be very, very different from what, it's so subtle and so attached to language, especially because there's this distinction between sort of literary irony and situational irony. And so we have a whole sort of canon of literary irony that is a somewhat specific technique or mechanism. But then there's this broader class of just irony, of which literary irony is just a small part. And so I have a feeling the literary irony would be very different across languages, but that irony as a concept probably has some threads that run across.
And just for trivializing this, your talk reminds me of almost all the Woody Allen movies, especially the one of the last ones, The Irrational Man. Oh, you saw that?
I haven't seen it.
Well, it's about a professor who comes on a summer tour at a university, and he's an expert in existentialism. and he's very depressed and unhappy until he finds that he may be able to help a person he doesn't even know by killing their spouse. And suddenly everything becomes real. Existentialism means something.
Uh-huh.
The absurdity was that by doing something violent and meaningless, that it gave him some meaning in life.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe Woody Allen understands these things much more than me giving credit.
I could see that. There's definitely some. I think Woody Allen has some great, rich irony. In fact, a lot of the play there is irony. I'm thinking of. Small Time Crooks. Is that kind of, yeah. You know, you get what you want, and then it's not what you want. Or that's what you want is the last thing you want. There's irony there too. Comedy, I think that's why comedy is so valuable. Lenny Bruce or whoever, it's like comedy is one of our quickest conduits to the absurd, to the ironic, and that I think is a huge part of its value.
I'm going to end on a pretty practical question. But first, I can't resist saying, as somebody who has voted ever since she was 21 in almost every election that came along, let me say that for next November, given the political climate, given the candidates that we are offered, it's not going to be easy for me to make choices and vote. But my practical question: there are many academic people over 65, let's say, who want to use the knowledge railroad, but are really frustrated by the mechanics of the technology. Do you have advice for us?
If I'm perfectly frank, I think my strongest advice is that for the most part, it's overrated. Really, I mean, there's not much you can find. There's plenty you can find. There's all sorts of novelties. There are endless videos of cats. I have this discussion sometimes with regard to Facebook, because I don't have a Facebook, and so I'll talk to people and they'll say, oh, but I need it to find out about stuff. And my response to that, and I think it could maybe be generalized a bit, is, well, if I got to find out about it that way, I don't really want to know about it. And in the same way, you know, there's interesting commentary and incredible knowledge online, but there are other ways to access it too. And I think if as soon as the technology is only useful insofar as it is efficient. So the moment that it's less efficient than doing it another way, just do it the other way. There's no inherent value in it. And I think oftentimes, whatever value might be there is taken away by distractions and advertisements and all these things. So there's really a balance there, I think. But I would say, don't stress about, like, don't stress.
Okay. Would you have a minute to go into some of the history of the Internet, how it started as a defense project, and many times it's used to undermine other countries, that there's a darker side to the Internet that we don't really think about? Could you go a little bit into that?
Sure. So I guess starting from where we are, you know, for the most part nowadays, the Internet is something that we use to look at funny pictures and maybe read some news stories, and it's obviously important. It's a fairly fundamental system, but in our day-to-day lives, it has a certain lightness. But it did start as not exactly a military project. It was. There had been some academic research into technologies that they called packet switching. And the military took an interest. The what's now called DARPA, what was then called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Administration of the Department of Defense, put out basically a bid or a proposal for bids to develop a packet network, not between military installations, but between academic centers. So for instance, between Lincoln Lab and MIT. These, of course, are institutions that are ostensibly academic, but really serve as the nexus between the military, industrial, and academic complexes, which then and now are pretty tightly connected. So they put out a bid, and it actually ended up being a private firm called BBN out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, that won the bid, built the system. It was installed in Berkeley, Caltech, MIT, and then from there expanded to academic institutions, was connected in with contemporaneous military networks, and then when the post-grad researchers started messing with it and fussing with it and just doing the unexpected with it, that's when it began to dawn on people that there was a value here outside of sharing data sets. So for instance, the first act of e-commerce was someone at Berkeley selling someone at Caltech a giant block of weed over a message board in the mid-70s. But obviously that was not the intended purpose of the system. So once that sort of started to dawn on people, then of course our government said, well, we should capitalize on this, and so sort of sold it off, and that's how we ended up with it as a sort of free and open capitalist system.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Isaac Wilder, and his topic tonight is called Seriously Ironic: Irony in a Post-Irony World. Hope you enjoyed the presentation. It was recorded on Sunday, the 29th of November, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and her staff at the All Souls Church for their help in presenting this program each week for you all. You can also access this program via podcast on KKFI's website page. That is www.kkfi.org. And we encourage you to check into the archives of not only the All Souls Forum, but also the other public affairs programs we have archived in that area. There's a lot of good information and programs there for your use. So feel free to make use of our website for that. The music you're hearing in the background, as always, each week is composed and performed by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. Tune in again next week, same time, same place, right here on KKFI for another All Souls Forum. We will hear from the Kansas City City Manager, Troy Schulte. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.